Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 8th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, a crustacean's powerful biological hammer, the health implications of mass gatherings, and a special issue on the bugs in our gut.
There's much greater variation between people at the level of our microbiomes than there is at the level of our human genomes.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Imagine that by balling up your hand into a fist, you could crack open a clam with one blow. Your incredibly powerful fist, now more fit for a superhero, can move at speeds up to 45 miles per hour and exert up to 200 pounds of force. What we can only dream of is reality for a marine crustacean known as the stomatopod or mantis shrimp, and it's only 15 centimeters long. In a report this week, a team of researchers describes the complex chemical and mechanical properties that make these shrimp fists so strong. I spoke with senior author David Casalis about the intricacies of these so-called dactyl clubs.
We studied this organism's fist since it can actually strike its prey with an incredible acceleration and force over and over, in fact, tens of thousands of times, without failing. In fact, a researcher, Sheila Patek, who I believe is now at UMass, showed that it's the fastest feeding strike of any organism that we know of. So, of course, it was very interesting to us. And what we found was that the club is both stiff and tough, two properties that are typically inversely related. And it achieves this through a unique architecture that the organism has evolved. And the cool thing about our study is that for decades, researchers have actually been studying different types of biomineralized organisms to learn about impact-resistant designs. And yet, the same organisms that have been studied actually become the mantis shrimp's dinner.
So what exactly does a mantis shrimp use this fist, this club, for?
Right. So the mantis shrimp have actually evolved. At first, they had barbs on the ends of their appendage, or spears, if you will. So they would spear fish and other soft organisms. But when they encountered an organism that they'd want to eat that might have a shell, like a clam, for example, they would use their elbow to smash it and try and break it. So obviously, ones that evolved to have larger elbows would survive, and therefore this elbow evolved into a smashing apparatus. So actually, there's two types of stomatopods. There's smashers and spears, or slashers, if you will. And so it uses either appendage, depending on which organism we're studying, to either impale its prey or smash its prey.
Sounds like a horror movie.
It's very aggressive, and they're very territorial as well.
So you've mentioned that this appendage, this hammer, is extremely strong and extremely durable. Can you go into some detail about that, about, you know, the kinds of forces that it can exert and endure?
Sure. So first of all, I have to acknowledge people that have done work on the forces that are generated from this club. So again, there's a body of work that's been done about 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago now by Sheila Patek and Roy Caldwell. And Sheila found that the mantis shrimp can actually generate forces of hundreds of newtons, more than 200 pounds for an organism that's only 10 centimeters long.
Wow.
And she used high-speed cameras, actually, to determine its acceleration rates. It accelerates faster than a .22-caliber bullet underwater. I mean, that's incredible. We're talking about speeds like 45 miles an hour underwater. And because it accelerates so fast, it actually shears the water. It's gliding past this water at such a high rate, it literally cavitates the water, so you create cavitation. So what happens is the organism will first strike its prey with the club, but within half a millisecond after that strike, there's a secondary implosion of these cavitation bubbles that will then implode on the prey and do further damage. So, of course, we're interested because the forces that it can exert and the cavitation that it causes, how can the club itself survive that in tens of thousands of times?
So how can it survive these forces? What exactly is it made of?
Right. So our findings were really astonishing, and I'm sure that's why science found it interesting as well. We found the dactyl club which is, again, this smashing appendage at the end of its arm, was not a simple type of material, but in fact, it was a highly complex structure, a composite, with regional variation. There were three different regions that we found within the club that played a very important yet synergistic role during the strike. The three regions really are quite different from one another. It has first an outer layer consisting of the same mineral that's actually found in human bone, calcium phosphate hydroxide, so hydroxyapatite.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's very highly crystalline, and the mineral is specifically oriented to withstand large compressive stresses during an impact. So after it impacts, there's a stress wave that will go through the club. So that causes, obviously, stresses within the club. So there's a second region that we found on the interior of the club that actually consists of a mixture of calcium phosphate, just like there is in the impact layer, and calcium carbonate minerals, but they're actually not crystalline. They're amorphous, and they act as a mineral matrix, and they're surrounded by organic fibers called chitin. And chitin is just basically a polysaccharide, a complex sugar. And these chitin fibrils are assembled in a helicoidal-like architecture. So the combination of the chitin fibrils with the mineral surrounding it made this area of the club incredibly impact-resistive and tough. So it absorbs a lot of energy. What's interesting is that as engineers, we try to build things so strong so that they don't fail. But in fact, when they do fail, they fail catastrophically. And the stomatopods do something completely different. So in fact, what stomatopods and most of nature does is they actually build structures that actually do have flaws built into them so that these flaws will act as, let's say, points of failure, but at the nanoscale. So they're used to avoid catastrophic failure of the entire structure. So you can have miles and miles of cracks within this dactyl club of the mantis shrimp that are formed, but they're all localized. So basically, you know, this is how the mantis shrimp can strike and absorb so much energy without catastrophically failing.
Right. And so this helicoidal structure, which is really beautiful, by the way, the cross-section of it in the image of it in the story is really quite striking. So this allows for many little micro fractures, but they'll never or hardly ever propagate into big fat fractures.
That's correct. There's a long distance they'd have to go to propagate. There's a third and final region of the club. And this is interesting as well. It's actually on the sides of the club. And it's made of the same chitinous fibers that are found in the interior region, but the chitin fibers in this region actually are oriented in one direction, and they wrap all the way around the entire club, and we believe that it places the entire club under compression so that during a strike, cracks that may have been produced won't be allowed to propagate further. And in fact, people do this in engineering with ceramic bearings. They put hot metal rings around a ceramic bearing, and when those rings cool, they place the ceramic under compression. So this third region kind of keeps the club intact, if you will.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So how does this whole, all these materials together, the whole structure here, compare to other industrial materials that we may use for the same sort of smashing purposes?
That's actually a really good question. So let me give you an example of the performance of, let's say, the impact region of the club. It sees an incredible amount of stress focused on that region during a high-speed impact. And remember, that region is actually just made of bone-like material. And yet, because of the precise guidance of mineral formation and control over its orientation in the club, these structures actually can withstand about 4 gigapascals of force. So now, that's an example of the club, how it's, you know, the type of stresses that it's undergoing in an impact. Imagine now, in comparison, there's engineering ceramics like zirconium oxide and silicon carbide, two very useful engineering ceramics made at high temperatures and they're high strength. Well, these materials can withstand roughly 2 to 3 gigapascals of stress. So here you have a mantis shrimp making its structure out of complex sugars and bone-like mineral, and almost double the, you know, compressive strength of an engineering ceramic.
So I imagine then that your findings must really have a lot of practical applications. So how can these industrial processes and materials benefit from what you found here?
Sure. So there's so many different applications for having materials that are both stiff and tough. And I'll give you an example. Before I became faculty at UCR, I worked in industry at HRL Labs in Malibu, and they work with both Boeing and General Motors. And, of course, having lightweight, impact-resistant body panels that can be fail-safe, if you will, would be huge. And so we could potentially extend this to that, but even beyond, for example, electric vehicles, where we want energy efficiency, weight is a huge issue. So if we can make composite materials that were impact resistant and lightweight, you know, we could extend the driving distance of electric vehicles. That's one example. But, for example, our soldiers that are put in harm's way overseas and our police, body armor and vehicle armor that can defeat, for example, improvised explosive devices would be critical for saving lives. And then finally, how about just our sporting arena? You know, with so many athletes getting concussions, we could potentially develop helmets, for example, to withstand the blunt force that football players receive on impact. And there's just too many to list.
Well, nature certainly is beautiful.
Absolutely.
Well, David Casales, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
David Casales and colleagues describe the mechanical properties of the mantis shrimp's dactyl club in a report this week.
We are host to a megalopolis, a city of cities inside our guts. The denizens of this dense ecosystem not only help us process food, but also shape our immune system from an early age. This week, Science and Science Translational Medicine teamed up for a special joint issue on the gut microbiota, the bacteria, archaea, eukaryotes, and their viruses that live together in the human gut. I spoke with Jeff Gordon, who authored perspectives for both journals, about why studying our resident microbes is important and how a greater understanding may help to feed our growing global population.
We are not superior to, but in fact are assimilated by the microbes that dominate our planet. We are this amalgamation of microbial and human life. And of course, we're not unique in that regard because all animal life on planet Earth has to adapt, coexist with, and benefit from the microbes that dominate our biosphere.
So what you're saying is that we're not individuals anymore, but we're a collection of cells, some of which are human cells, some of which are other organisms.
Au contraire, I'm saying we're very much individuals. Mm-hmm. It's just in terms of viewing ourselves as individuals, we should think of ourselves as a summation of these microbial and human parts. And viewed from the perspective of genes, there's much greater variation between people at the level of our microbiomes than there is at the level of our human genomes. So part of our distinctiveness from a genetic perspective, and I would also argue from a functional perspective, comes from this collection of microbes that assemble in our bodies beginning at the moment of birth.
Well, the study of our relationship with those collections of microbes has really exploded as a field of research, and it offers completely new ways of looking at evolution, diet, nutrition, development. Can you walk us through a bit of the history of this field?
The concepts, the questions, the wonderment dates back to the earliest days of microbiology. And if you go back 100 years, you'll be able to find in the literature individuals looking at the impact, for instance, of diet on the microbiota. Metchnikoff speculating about the concept of dysbiosis, which would be a state of microbial imbalance where there are configurational changes in the microbiota that produce disruptions in the normal peaceful existence between our microbial communities and ourselves. People had this wonderful explosion of information in the 60s and 70s when there were tremendous advances in culturing anaerobic microorganisms. The same issues of how do these parts relate to one another? How do these communities assemble? The role of diet in driving that assembly, the role of host factors, these things are all on their minds, just like they're on the minds of people now, just that we have different tools.
Really interesting. But you also raise some tricky ethical and legal regulatory issues that are brought up by this kind of research. Can you share a few examples of those?
The road ahead is very interesting at many different levels. And I would say that in part, they're a consequence of our progress in our attempt to deliberately manipulate our microbial cells in order to prevent disease or enhance health. The ability, for instance, to transplant human gut communities into mice that were raised under germ-free conditions and to feed these animals the very human diets that the donors themselves consume to see how diet and microbes intersect to affect relationships with the immune system, shaping of metabolism. All of these tools are allowing people to think about ways of discovering next generation probiotic species, next next-generation food ingredients that could deliberately manipulate our microbial communities in ways that will benefit. Now, if you think about this, the question would be, if we discover these microbes that could be beneficial, and these are microbes that are entrenched members of normal gut communities, who owns them? Would the lead compounds emanating from these discovery pipelines be viewed by regulatory agencies as drugs? Is the food by microbiota interaction that we think is going to be highlighted by some of this work going to transform people's views of food as medicines and as a consequence, even though we might herald a new era of precision nutrition? How will claims be made? How will they be vetted? The very structures of current regulatory agencies, I think, will be impacted by this line of investigation. You know, it is this magical thought that there's an invisible world that envelops us, that helps shape our health, and in many respects is a reflection of our life choices, our legacy of interactions with other individuals and a family, our personal decisions, including decisions about what to eat. That raises the specter of trying to understand the forces that shape our well-being. Any interventions that will occur, whether they be food-based or food and microbes together or microbial-based, would have to understand the cultural traditions of the individuals who would be the hope for beneficiaries of these sorts of activities.
So switching to the perspective that you wrote for Science Translational Medicine, you focus on specific areas of human health, such as malnutrition and stunting. What are some of the possible connections between the gut microbiota and stunted growth?
The repertoire of gene functions that are represented in our microbiomes evolved towards an adult-like state in the first 3 years of life. And studies, including studies by our group, are showing that differences in cultural traditions, notably those that are evident between highly economically developed westernized society versus less or least economically developed societies, impact microbiome configurations. Many of the genes that are affected are involved in the manufacture or processing of micro and macronutrients. So part of our definition of nutritional needs may have to, and probably should, incorporate knowledge of microbiome variation. We also know that there's increasing evidence that the nutritional value of food is influenced in part by not only the structure, but the dynamic operations of a gut microbial community, and that food in turn shapes the microbiome. All of this is transforming our definition of nutritional needs and status at different ages, and we can ask the question how different socioeconomic and cultural settings influence our nutritional state.
Right. I thought it was really interesting how you talked about the prevalence of stunting through generations in places where malnutrition is really common.
This is not just idle thoughts. We're under enormous pressure to devise new ways to feed healthy foods to a human population whose size is predicted to expand to 9 to 10 billion by 2050. And given that pressure, plus changes in water and land resource availability and food distribution systems and patterns of food choices and cultural traditions, economic status, we have to be highly strategic in our thinking about what types of food should and can be produced, how to prepare and preserve them, and selecting the optimal target consumer population. That's what I mean when I said the gut microbiome may drive a new era of precision nutrition. But we also have to think of how can we leap forward in time and forecast the nutritional value of different types of crops that are being generated, either through natural selection or genetic engineering, for a consumer population that's either within the currently existing distribution system for that crop or derived food product, or is more geographically or culturally distant. So how do you create preclinical models that can simulate a matrix of different combinations of foods, food products, and a microbiota? I think that's going to be very, very important when we come to understand the role of the microbiome in stunting, because it's clear that food insecurity alone can't explain the epidemiological features of moderate to severe forms of malnutrition. And hopefully the microbiome viewed by students and postdocs at time present as a way, a portal to addressing a number of global health problems. And their captivation with the microbiome, I hope, will influence their commitment to addressing some of these global health problems, whether they be at the level of the nutritional status of mothers and infants in the developing world, or the increasing incidence of immunopathologic states that we see associated with westernization.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is such a fascinating topic. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other topics that are brought up in this special issue?
These issues were designed to have an intentional dialogue between basic scientists who are looking at fundamental questions related to the ecology of the microbiome, the relationships between microbial citizens in these very complex communities and the innate and adaptive immune system, and also about the metabolic activities that these communities perform. And these articles, their overviews, their analysis, their critiques of the field, are talking to another series of articles where the challenges of translating this basic information to the bedside is discussed. And I think an interesting set of conversations in these joint issues centers around microbiota-directed therapeutics and the need for an ecological perspective. Mm-hmm. For instance, how can we target small collections of organisms, manipulate their representation either by precision antibiotics, vaccines, the dialogue between the microbiota and the immune system. How can the immune system sense the metabolic activities of the microbiota, and how are those signals transformed into changes in the functions of different immune cell subsets? How are fences created between the microbiota and the host? And how wonderfully the innate system has evolved to produce a variety of antimicrobial factors that keeps this fence intact, these relationships peaceful and productive, and what goes wrong and why, and how can we repair these fences?
Wow, that covers a lot of ground, and I think there's even more in both journals. Jeff Gordon, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Jeff Gordon writes about the gut microbiota this week in Science and Science Translational Medicine. You can read articles from both journals at www.sciencemag.org/special/gut_micro or at the hashtag gutbio on Twitter.
So, sports fans, are you planning on attending this summer's Olympic Games? Make sure you bring hand sanitizer, as well as sunblock. Health officials worry that such mass gatherings are hotbeds of infectious diseases like measles and meningitis, as people from around the world crowd together in tiny spaces. But history tells us that such gatherings are just as likely to come and go without major negative health impacts. Kai Kupferschmidt has the story on why health officials are concerned and why predictions are so hard to make.
Europe is hosting two of the biggest sporting events in the world this summer. It's the European Football Championship, which is being hosted by Poland and the Ukraine, and then there's the Summer Olympic Games, which are being hosted by London. And a lot of public health experts are very worried that these events might serve as hubs for infectious diseases. One of the things that they're especially worried about is measles, because there's a big measles outbreak in the Ukraine that is currently going on. So historically, these big events have not actually had that much impact on infectious diseases. And that is something that scientists are really looking into and trying to understand. And one of the things that they want to do is really to use the London Olympics to look at this.
So this is all part of a newly emerging field known as mass gathering health. So what does this field entail, and why is it really only emerging now?
Well, mass gathering health really looks at all of the effects on health that such mass gatherings can have. So obviously, when you put millions of people in one place, you'll also be looking at, you know, a risk of panic and stampedes. You have crush injuries. Mm-hmm. People might suffer from heat exhaustion or dehydration. So all of these things factor in, and then also communicable diseases like measles and other diseases, which might be spread and which might actually have an impact beyond this mass event when all of these people take this infection home with them. One of the reasons that it's only really becoming its own field now, I think, is that also mass gatherings are just becoming more common. I mean, we are becoming more humans on the planet, and then also people find it a lot easier to travel to such events nowadays. So there's a lot of such huge events that happen every year, and more people are going to them. Regarding sports events, probably the most important recent example is the Vancouver Olympics. So in 2010, Vancouver hosted the Winter Olympics, and three Canadians went to an Olympics-related event downtown and they got infected with measles. Now, measles has been eradicated in the Americas, so there are no measles there. So it's apparent that they got it from someone who traveled to these Olympic Games. And it touched off the biggest measles outbreak in British Columbia since 1997. 82 people were sickened, and I think a quarter of them actually had to be hospitalized. So it was quite a severe epidemic for Canada. But if you look at the big number of sports events that happen around the world, the number of really severe outbreaks has actually been quite small.
Now, one particular kind of event that you talk about a lot in your article is religious gatherings, spiritual gatherings, and some of those have been going on for millennia. So can you talk about the sorts of experiences that we've had with those sorts of gatherings?
Right. The field of mass gathering health really has its root in the Hajj. That's the sacred journey to Mecca that every Muslim is called to undertake at least once. And the Hajj obviously has been going on for hundreds of years, but it's only become apparent in the last few decades how much of an impact it can have on public health. And the Saudi government has really tried to look at this. For example, in 1987, a bacterium called Neisseria meningitidis, which can cause meningitis and sepsis, and it actually causes a lot of deaths, spread around the world, starting at the Hajj, and people became very worried about it, and then the Saudi government started requiring Hajj travelers to be vaccinated against this pathogen. And then in March 2000, a new strain of it emerged at the Hajj, and it was carried back to Africa, to Europe, to the United States, and touched off small epidemics there. So now, since 2002, a vaccination against this new strain is needed if you want to travel to the Hajj. And historically, there have always been outbreaks associated with the Hajj. There's also been outbreaks of plague and typhus outbreaks historically.
But as you alluded to earlier, the health impacts of these sorts of mass gatherings are not always easy to measure, and they're not always consistent. You gave an example earlier of measles at the Vancouver Olympics, but have we always seen these sorts of outbreaks at sporting events?
There's actually a lot of examples of mass gatherings where people haven't been able to find any impact, especially with sports events. So, for example, people have looked very closely at the Football World Cup in Germany in 2006. They've looked at the Football World Cup in South Africa in 2010 and also at various Olympics. And they haven't really been able to find any increase in infectious diseases in the host population or in the countries that people have been traveling from. But one of the reasons that might be the case is that in the case of sports events, it's really a very specific crowd of people. So usually it's quite affluent, healthy people coming from rich countries, and they don't actually spend that much time in the countries where they're going for the sports event. So sports events might also be the events that have the least impact. On the other hand, religious gatherings, it's a very different type of crowd. With the Hajj, for example, you have a lot of people who are quite old, because they want to do the Hajj before they die. They might be very ill, or they just come from developing countries and they have saved for many years in order to be able to pay for the Hajj. And then you have these millions of people, and they're crowded together in prayer. They live in tent cities a lot of times. So it's a very different setting. I mean, both of these are mass gatherings, but in the one case, the conditions might not actually be that positive for bacteria, while in the other case, they might be.
How interesting. So there's sort of a socioeconomic and also just a general demographic aspect to, you know, how these events turn out.
Right.
So then with all of this more or less conflicting data, how are researchers approaching these upcoming games in Europe? You know, how are they preparing for them and what are they planning to learn from them?
Well, I think the message has really been telling people to get vaccinated against measles, against polio, and against some other diseases if they want to travel to these events. At the same time, researchers say they are quite confident that in these sports events, usually the risk isn't that big. But of course, you never know. In the case of the Ukraine, there have been 9,000 cases of measles this year. So if people travel there and they aren't vaccinated, there is a real risk that they will get infected with the virus and that they might take it back, for example, to the U.S. where measles is eradicated. So there is a real risk, but at the same time, everything that we know of sports events in the past tells us that the risk is quite small. So, as usual, you know, people are saying they have to prepare for the worst. So there is surveillance at the games. People will be looking very closely for any infectious diseases that anyone associated with the games or with the football championship might have. And then there's also researchers at the Olympic Games in London researchers who have been modeling where people will be traveling into London from. They've looked at the ticket sales. They've looked at where people have been traveling to London from in the last 5 years. And they will be taking all of this data together with surveillance data of infectious diseases around the world to really come up with a prediction of what infectious diseases you would expect to see in London during the Olympics. And then after the Olympics, they want to see what was actually observed and how this model compares to reality and how you might be able to explain why something happened or why we see certain diseases coming up that we weren't expecting or the other way around.
Well, we can all hope that the upcoming games will be on the more safe and secure end of this spectrum. So, Kai Cooper-Schmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kai Cooper-Schmidt is a contributing correspondent for Science and writes about the field of mass gathering health in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First up, David, we have kind of a hot topic these days, whole genome sequencing.
Right. But Sarah, this isn't sequencing of adults or even children. This is sequencing of the unborn. Now, anybody who has been pregnant or knows somebody who has knows that we can already get some DNA information from fetuses. Doctors can do amniocentesis or something called villus sampling, which is basically just taking a snippet of placental tissue. But as you can imagine, both of these are pretty invasive. They involve getting a needle or a tube into the womb or the placenta, and this can actually cause miscarriages. So it's not ideal. But a lot of parents obviously want to know if their child has major genetic defects before bringing that child to term. So the question is there a better way of doing it that's not as invasive? And that's what this study is all about.
Yeah, I really like their method of taking advantage of the fact that DNA of the fetus escapes into the mom's bloodstream.
Actually, researchers have known since 1997 that there's actually a lot of free-floating DNA in the mom that is not hers but actually comes from the fetus. And in 2010, researchers showed there's actually enough of this fetal DNA swimming around that it should be possible, theoretically, to reconstruct all or almost all of the fetus's genome from this DNA. And in this new study, researchers actually have done just that. One of the hurdles has been that it's really actually hard to distinguish fetal DNA from the mother's DNA because obviously the fetuses are sharing half of their DNA with the mom. So how do you distinguish one from the other? The idea is that if they're using statistical analysis, you should be able to tell there should be more of certain genetic variants present in the mom if both she has it and the fetus has it. And that's one way to sort of separate out the fetus's DNA from the mother's DNA. Also, they can actually take saliva samples from the dad to help sort of sort out what DNA is coming from the father and what is coming from the mother and what's coming from the fetus. So putting all this together, the researchers found that they could reconstruct a baby's genome with about 98% accuracy.
Which sounds great, but...
Which sounds great. It actually is really great. I mean, it's definitely much better than anybody could do before. There are a few drawbacks. If what are called new mutations form, these are new mutations that would form either after the sperm fuse with the egg or even in the sperm and the egg themselves. So it's mutations that would be present in the baby that might not actually be present in the parents. This new analysis actually missed a lot of them, actually created a lot of false positives as well, which is bad because you don't want to be thinking that your baby's going to have a disease that it actually doesn't.
So is this something that people can seek out today? Is it something they can get at a clinic?
With current technology, the researchers say it costs them about $50,000 per child to do the study. So this isn't the kind of thing that would be within most people's financial reach. But as with all genetic advances, the technology has a way of catching up with our finances pretty rapidly. Researchers are quickly closing in on the $1,000 genome, this ability to sort of sequence our entire genome for $1,000. So that suggests that probably within a few years, this technology actually may be both better than it is right now, but also a lot more financially viable.
Well, next up, we have a story that something I've never thought of before. What do mosquitoes do in the rain? How do they handle these missiles from the sky?
Right. Sarah, sometimes science answers questions that we haven't even asked. I certainly wasn't asking why raindrops don't swat down mosquitoes. But as you implied, scientists have actually figured out why this happens. And the reason it's such a mystery is because a raindrop falling on a mosquito is actually a pretty major collision. Raindrops weigh about 50 times as much as a mosquito weighs. It'd be like one of us being hit by a bus.
Wow.
And yet mosquitoes fly around in the rain all the time. And as far as we know, not a lot of them are getting killed by raindrops. So what's happening here? And actually, to figure it out, the researchers created a sort of a game of insect pinball. They got a bunch of mosquitoes into what they call a flight arena, which is basically a 20 centimeter high acrylic cage covered with a mesh top. And they basically shot jets of water at the mosquitoes to sort of replicate a raindrop hitting them from a very high altitude. And they filmed all this with a high-speed video camera. And what they found is, first of all, most of the mosquitoes, in fact, all the mosquitoes, were able to recover from the impacts of the drops without crashing to the bottom of the cage. The drops weren't killing the insects. They weren't even driving them into the ground.
And the insects weren't evading them.
A lot of times what was happening is that the drops weren't hitting the insects head-on. They were just doing glancing blows to the wings or the legs, and the insects were able to pretty quickly recover. But even when the insects got a direct hit, they still recovered after falling no more than about 20 body lengths. So they fell a little bit, but then they were able to basically fly away, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, there's some great video of this on
the site.
There's
some great video on the site.
And they just drop out of the screen
after the
drop hits them. So how are the mosquitoes able to deal with this?
They have a hard exoskeleton, which is almost like a coat of armor that they wear. That protects them a little bit. But researchers say the main protection is actually that the drops actually aren't hitting the mosquitoes with as much force as we think they are. They did a few more experiments, and they found that the water drops only slowed by about 2 to 17% when they hit the mosquito, which means that the drops are still retaining a lot of their energy. They're pretty much falling at the same rate they were before. If they were losing a lot of energy, they'd be transferring it to the insect as crushing force, which would really hurt or even kill the insect. But the fact that the drops keep on pretty much going at the same speed and are not really getting deformed after hitting the insect indicates that the insects really aren't absorbing a lot of force when they're getting hit by these drops. So in some ways, it's really not like us being hit by a bus, more like us sort of being tapped by a bus, and therefore the insects are able to fly away and bite us another day.
Okay. Our last story is on black holes roaming the universe.
Well, Sarah, we know there's black holes out there. We know there's very big black holes out there. But most of the black holes we know about are located in the center of a galaxy, which means that they're probably doing a lot of maybe not so pleasant stuff at the center of the galaxy, but they're sort of constrained in the center of the galaxy. But astronomers have wondered for a while if it's possible for one of these black holes to escape from its galaxy and start sort of free floating through the universe, which is a bit of a scary concept. And it's got some new evidence in its favor thanks to this new study.
And so what were astronomers able to detect that made them think that this was going on?
They saw these two mysterious bright spots in a galaxy called CID 42. These galaxies never have very interesting names. 4 billion light years from Earth. And they trained the Hubble Space Telescope on these spots. And they found out that they belong to two very compact light sources. One seemed to be at the galaxy center, and the other one was a little offset from the center. They did a little bit more observation, and they discovered that the one that was offset from the center seemed to be emitting X-rays. And that's a very good sign that it is indeed a black hole. When black holes munch away at gas that's surrounding them, they emit X-rays. So they said, you know, it looks like this dot, which looks like a black hole, is not in its galaxy center, which means it looks like it somehow escaped from its galaxy or is in the process of escaping from the center of its galaxy.
These are two supermassive black holes. How do they end up so close together?
Well, what the researchers think happened is that CID 42 is actually the product of two galaxies slamming into each other. And since galaxies usually have a central black hole, it's possible that when these galaxies merged, that you would get two black holes.
So if this black hole is on its way out, how is it moving?
It's a good question. And with a little bit more analysis, the astronomers found that the black hole seems to be being expelled from the galaxy at about 2,000 kilometers a second. And that speed matches the velocity expected to be imparted by the asymmetric emission of gravitational waves. And this is basically ripples in space-time that Einstein predicted would be generated when heavy objects like black holes are accelerated. And if a black hole emits more gravitational waves in one direction than another, the body will recoil in the opposite direction with a speed fast enough to escape the galaxy.
Wow. Well, is this something that we're going to see more and more of as we increase our observations?
Well, hopefully not, because these solo black holes could be a lot of trouble. They are not fun to have around. They can even, the researchers say, alter the evolution of galaxies. So we wouldn't really want a lot of these out there. And the team doesn't really think there are. They think this is an extremely rare phenomenon. So don't be expecting a black hole to collide with Earth anytime soon.
It would make a good movie, though.
It would make a good movie.
Okay, well, what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about why insects aren't the size of hawks anymore, something we can all be thankful for. Also about Pluto's newest moons, how much they weigh, and what they can tell us about the orbits of alien worlds. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a collaboration between Japan and the United States, predicting and dealing with future natural disasters. Also a story about the open access movement. This is a movement to grant the public free access to scientific research that is funded with taxpayer dollars. What is the latest on that? And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the microbiome. This is all of the microbes that live inside our body and how they influence our health. And next week's Science Live is tied to Father's Day in the U.S. It's about how fatherhood differs between different animal communities. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
I'll check that out. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the June 8th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.